And it so happened that it coincided my starting to become nervous about the society I was living in coincided with a job offer from a Jewish and Palestinian NGO to start writing their funding applications to the United States, because as English is my mother tongue. And I wrote an application to United States, to a feminist organization in San Francisco. How would I change my society as a woman with $50,000? And wow, you can change the world with $50,000. But anyway, it was a very successful article, and we received $50,000, and we did indeed set up women's empowerment groups in Arab towns and villages in Israel, and also in deprived Jewish areas. Let us be honest here, and let me explain to you that Jews from Arab countries, probably known to you as Sephardi Jews, suffer from the same social policies that Palestinians suffer from. My family, my own family, for example, I have two cousins who emigrated to Israel in 1960 from South Africa, and their children married Moroccan Jews who are black as night. And what is the first language? So our second cousins are black, and what is the first language that they speak in the home? Arabic. So this gives you some idea of just how schizophrenic Israeli society is. And Israel likes to present itself to the world as a very united society. But in fact, the truth is that it's only united if there's a war. Although there are worldwide hundreds of thousands of Jews who think like me, when it comes to the issue of war, our voices are sandbagged by the government. And so it's very easy for people to worldwide to think that there are no voices of Jewish dissent inside Israel. And in fact, it's not true. It was after I started working with this NGO that one day they said to me, we'd like you to start writing about the Arab part of Israel. And I said, well, I can't, because I don't know anything really about it. So they said, I'd like you to go to the town of Tamra, which is now my home. And as we drove off the main highway, we went past a very beautiful Jewish settlement, which was situated on a hill. And I said to the driver, let's go in here. And there were beautiful homes with gardens, some with swimming pools, little play areas for the children, street lighting, garbage collection, beautifully tended roads. This was a wealthy community. And it was nestling in the hills right next door to Tamra, where I was going. As we entered to Tamra, you would think that we had entered into another planet. It was depressing, filthy. There was garbage everywhere. There are rats like this size in the streets. There is very, very high density living. There's 30,000 people in Tamra on 1,000 dunams of land, which I suppose to you would be equal to something like 6 football pitches. By 2020, we'll be 42 to 45,000 people on the same amount of land. In the settlement that I have just previously described, there are 600 people on 4,000 dunams of land, 4 times the amount of land. By 2020, Tamra, and I'm only going to take Tamra because Tamra, not only is it my home, but it's also totally representative of every major Palestinian locality in Israel, suffers from all of the social breakdown and disintegration and fragmentation that goes with a town, a society that suffers from two major problems. While it is grossly underfunded and neglected at every level of life, and two, the mainstream society of its own country, where its own people are born and own land, sends a continuous message that you are not wanted here. And what two things happen as a result of all of this? One is Hezbollah and the other is Hamas. And you don't have to have a PhD in political science to understand that if you've read adequately and you've traveled to the Middle East and you understand the social framework of the Middle East and our life there, that the Israeli government in its current form, with its current policies of land expropriation, of under-budgeting, of constant vilification of Palestinian citizens, of continuously presenting them as if they were subversive entities in our midst, all goes to make for extremism. And it's not for nothing that we have very, very powerful Islamic movement in Umm al-Fahm, a major Arab town in Israel, which is led by Sheikh Raad Salah. I have great respect for him. He's one of the few Palestinian leaders in Israel that is really able to stand up to the government and speaks the truth. Not for nothing has he been imprisoned for 18 months. But if I look around me in Tamra, when I first arrived in Tamra 8 years ago, hardly any little girls wore the hijab. Now, this is not an attack on women who wear the hijab. After all, I live in Arab society. But there are two issues here. One, we have to ask ourselves, are women wearing the hijab because they feel that this is really a part of their religion and they feel they need to wear it? Or are they wearing it because the mainstream society is telling them that they are not wanted here? And the only way in which they can find their self-respect as a human being is by presenting themselves as definitely a member of Islam, definitely Palestinian, and definitely putting two fingers in the air to the government. Anybody here who's been in university and studied philosophy may know or should know, and if not, should start reading now, the philosophy of John Rawls, who explained very, John Rawls, R-A-W-L-S, who explains very clearly that human beings find their self-respect and their way to be able to express themselves in society by their political identity. That's a very, very important point. But here in Israel, although it's true we have Palestinian members of the Knesset, we even have a deputy, or we did have a deputy speaker of the Knesset, Dr. Ahmed Tibi, they are actually powerless. They are purely decorative. The Arab vote inside Israel is purely decorative, because Israel presents itself and wants to remain a Jewish state, that Palestinians, unless they go along with the concept of political Zionism and voting for a Zionist party, their voice is really null and void. And this is not a true democracy. What we live in Israel is a country that has become an ethnocracy. The major argument that is going on now, because we don't have a written constitution in Israel, but then I should remind you that neither does Great Britain, and they seem to manage quite well. I don't say it's perfect, but it certainly manages quite well. Is that the minute you say that the country is Jewish and democratic, this is already your defining an ethnocracy. Because here in Israel, my religion is my nationality. when I lived in Britain or South Africa, I can say I'm a South African citizen, but my religion is Jewish. But in Israel, being a Jew is my nationality. And what has happened is that this has brought many Jews who are at the forefront of the battle for change, like me and a few other people, that this has brought us into direct conflict with the values of our religion, with the ethical traditions and values of our religion. Judaism particularly is a religion that talks about preserving human dignity, respect for human life. It says very clearly in the Torah, Rabbi Hillel said, that thou shalt not do unto others that that you would not have done unto yourself. And yet we find ourselves through this ethnocracy bringing about on the Palestinians the very sort of discrimination which we ourselves have undergone in Europe. If Lieberman is to have his way, people who think and speak like me will be stripped of our citizenship. This, of course, is something that will be challenged if it happens to Jews who think like me and will be taken to the International Court in The Hague. We all know that Israel doesn't take any notice of any of the international courts or of the UN and is a law unto itself. And what is very, very alarming is that in a recent piece of research I've been making for a book about something quite different, I came across the legal concepts of the Third Reich during the rise of the Weimar Republic about how they would deal with the final solution, and that because of the way in which it would be done, they would not be responsible to any international courts, and therefore they were not guilty. And this all came out during the Eichmann trial. And this is the identical situation that is happening now in Israel. We have what's happened in Gaza. Oh, but we're the most moral army in the world. We're not responsible for that. We have what happens in the West Bank, that people spend all their day standing in a line with old people, sick people, women have babies at checkpoints. Who cares? And this is a sickness in Israeli society that sadly Germany feeds. And the reason you feed it is because of your foreign policy and because of your guilt. And what you are doing with your guilt and your foreign policy is actually helping us self-destruct. And this is one of the reasons why I decided it was so important to come to speak in Germany. The German population, who understand what's happening in Israel, have to take it upon themselves to speak out. By not speaking out, you are complicit. You've been complicit once, are you going to be complicit twice? There's a very nice way in which the German education authorities have started to teach the Holocaust in schools, and it's something which applies very much to Israeli society. The way in which they explain it now is that there was a society during the Third Reich. This was the economic situation of Germany, this was going on, that was going on. And society and people in it have choices. And that was the choice that you made. And what we do in Gaza and the West Bank is the choice that we've made. And we have a choice not to be complicit in that. Like, I have stepped outside of my society. I am outside the consensus of Jewish society. And I feel so strongly about German foreign policy. I feel so sick when I hear Angela Merkel say that forever Germany will be Israel's friend, right or wrong. And it is this sort of nonsense, this sort of feeding us honey all the time, when inside you know that it's morally wrong, people don't speak out.